Zeke starts to jog behind the wheelchair. Then, when he's almost too far away for me to see, he pushes himself up with the handles so that his feet aren't touching the ground, and together they fly down the middle of the street, Shauna shrieking, Zeke laughing. I turn left at the next intersection and start down the cracked sidewalk toward the building where Abnegation had its monthly faction-wide meetings. Though it feels like it has been a long time since I last went there, I still remember where it is. One block south, two blocks west. The sun inches toward the horizon as I walk. The color drains from the surrounding buildings in the evening light, so that they all appear to be gray. The face of Abnegation headquarters is just a cement rectangle, like all the other buildings in the Abnegation sector. But when I shove the front door open, familiar wood floors and rows of wooden benches arranged in a square greet me. In the center of the room is a skylight that lets in a square of orange sunlight. It is the room's only adornment. I sit on my family's old bench. I used to sit next to my father and Caleb, next to my mother. Now I feel like the only one left. The last Briar.
It's nice, isn't it?
Marcus walks in and sits down across from me, his hands folded in his lap. The sunlight is between us. He has a large bruise on his jaw from where Tobias hit him, and his hair is freshly buzzed. It's fine, I say, straightening. What are you doing here?
I saw you come in.
He examines his fingernails carefully.
And I want to have a word with you about the information Janine Matthews stole.
What if you're too late? What if I already know what it is? Marcus looks up from his fingernails, and his dark eyes narrow. The look is far more poisonous than any Tobias could muster, though he has his father's eyes.
You can't possibly.
You don't know that?
I do, actually. Because I have seen what happens to people when they hear the truth. They look like they have forgotten what they were searching for, and are just wandering around trying to remember.
A chill makes its way up my spine and spreads down my arms, giving me goosebumps. I know that Janine decided to murder half a faction to steal it, so it must be incredibly important, I say. I pause. I know something else, too, but I only just realized it. Right before I attacked Janine, she said, "This is not about you. It's not about me." And this meant what she was doing to me, trying to find a simulation that worked on me. On the Divergent. "I know it has something to do with the Divergent," I blurt out. "I know the information is about what's outside the fence."
"That is not the same thing as knowing what's outside the fence."
"Well, are you going to tell me, or are you going to dangle it over my head and make me jump for it?"
"I did not come here for self-indulgent arguing. And no, I am not going to tell you. But not because I don't want to. It's because I have no idea how to describe it to you. You have to see it for yourself."
As he speaks, I notice the sunlight turning more orange than yellow and casting darker shadows over his face. "I think Tobias might be right," I say. "You like to be the only one who knows. You like that I don't know. It makes you feel important. That's why you won't tell me, not because it's indescribable."
"That's not true."
"How am I supposed to know that?" Marcus stares, and I stare back.
"A week before the simulation attack, the Abnegation leaders decided it was time to reveal the information in the file to everyone. Everyone in the entire city. The day we intended to reveal it was approximately 7 days after the simulation attack. Obviously, we were unable to do so."
"She didn't want you to reveal what was outside the fence?" "Why not? How did she even know about it in the first place? I thought you said only the Abnegation leaders knew."
"We are not from here, Beatrice. We were all placed here, for a specific purpose. A while ago, the Abnegation were forced to enlist the help of Erudite in order to achieve that purpose. But eventually everything went awry because of Janine. Because she doesn't want to do what we are supposed to do. She would rather resort to murder."
Placed here. My brain feels like it is buzzing with information. I clutch the edge of the bench beneath me. "What are we supposed to do?" I say,
my voice barely more than a whisper.
I have told you enough to convince you that I am not a liar. As for the rest, I truly find myself unequal to the task of explaining it to you. I only told you as much as I did because the situation has become dire.
Dire. Suddenly I understand the problem. The factionless plan to destroy not only the important figures in Erudite, but all the data they have. They will level everything. I have never thought that plan was a good idea. But I knew that we could come back from it, because the Erudites still know the relevant information, even if they don't have their data. But this is something even the most intelligent Erudite do not know. Something that, if everything is destroyed, we cannot replicate. If I help you, I betray Tobias. I will lose him. I swallow hard. So you have to give me a good reason.
Aside from the good of everyone in our society?
Marcus wrinkles his nose in disgust.
That isn't enough for you?
Our society is in pieces. So no, it's not.
Marcus sighs. Your parents died for you.
It's true.
But the reason your mother was in Abnegation headquarters the night you were almost executed was not to save you. She didn't know you were there. She was trying to rescue the file from Janine. And when she heard that you were about to die, she rushed to save you. And left the file in Janine's hands.
That's not what she told me, I say hotly.
She was lying. Because she had to.
But Beatrice, the point is, your mother knew she probably would not get out of Abnegation headquarters alive. But she had to try. This file, it was something she was willing to die for. Understand? The Abnegation are willing to die for any person. Friend or enemy. If the situation calls for it. That is perhaps why they find it difficult to survive in life-threatening situations. But there are a few things they are willing to die for. They don't value many things in the physical world. So if he's telling me the truth, and my mother really was willing to die for this information to become public, I would do just about anything to accomplish the goal she failed to achieve. You're trying to manipulate me. Aren't you?
I suppose, he says, as shadows slip into his eye sockets like dark water. That is something you must decide for yourself.
Chapter 38. I take my time on my walk back to the Eaton house, and try to remember what my mother told me when she saved me from the tank during the simulation attack. Something about having watched the train since the attack started. I didn't know what I would do when I found you. But it was always my intention to save you. But when I go over the memory of her voice in my mind, it sounds different. I didn't know what I would do when I found you. Meaning, I didn't know how to save both you and the file. But it was always my intention to save you. I shake my head. Is that how she said it? Or am I manipulating my own memory because of what Marcus told me? There is no way to know. All I can do is decide if I trust Marcus or not. And while he has done cruel, evil things, our society is not divided into good and bad. Cruelty does not make a person dishonest, the same way bravery does not make a person kind. Marcus is not good or bad, but both. Well, he is probably more bad than good. But that doesn't mean he's lying. On the street ahead of me, I see the orange glow of fire. Alarmed, I walk faster, and see that the fire rises from large, man-sized metal bowls set up on the sidewalks. The Dauntless and the Factionless have gathered between them, a narrow divide separating one group from the other. And before them stand Evelyn, Harrison, Tori, and Tobias. I spot Christina, Uriah, Lynn, Zeke, and Shauna on the right side of the cluster of Dauntless, and stand with them. "Where have you been?" Christina says. "We looked all over for you." "I went for a walk. What's going on?"
"They're finally going to tell us the attack plan," says Uriah, looking eager.
"Oh," I say. Evelyn lifts her hands, palms out, and the Factionless fall silent. They are better trained than the Dauntless, whose voices take 30 seconds to peter out. "The past few weeks, we have been developing a plan to fight the Erudite,"
Evelyn says, her low voice carrying easily. And now that we have finished, we would like to share it with you. Evelyn nods at Tori, who takes over.
Our strategy is not pointed, but broad. There is no way to know who among the erudite supports Janine and who does not. It is therefore safer to assume that all those who do not support her have already vacated erudite headquarters.
We all know that erudite's power lies not in its people but in its information, says Evelyn.
As long as they still possess that information, we will never be free of them, especially while large numbers of us are wired for simulations. They have used information to control us and keep us under their thumb for far too long.
A shout, beginning among the factionless and spreading to the dauntless, rises up from the crowd like we are all part of one organism, following the commands of a single brain. But I am not sure what to think or how I feel. There is a part of me that is shouting too, clamoring for the destruction of every single erudite and all that they hold dear. I look at Tobias. His expression is neutral, and he stands behind the glow of firelight, where he is difficult to see. I wonder what he thinks of this.
I'm sorry to tell you that those of you who were shot with simulation transmitters will have to remain here, says Tori. Or you can be activated as a weapon of erudite at any time.
There are a few cries of protest, but no one seems all that surprised. They know too well what Janine can do with simulations, maybe. Lynn groans and looks at Uriah.
We have to stay?
You have to stay, he says.
You got shot too, she says.
I saw it. Divergent, remember? He says.
Lynn rolls her eyes, and he hurries on, probably to avoid hearing Lynn's divergent conspiracy theory again.
Anyway, I bet no one checks. And what are the odds she'll activate you specifically if she knows everyone else with simulation transmitters is staying behind?
Lynn frowns, considering this. But she looks more cheerful. As cheerful as Lynn gets, anyway, as Tori begins speaking again.
The rest of us will divide into groups of mixed factionless and dauntless, says Tori. A single large group will attempt to penetrate erudite headquarters and work its way up through the building, cleansing it of erudite's influence. Several other, smaller groups will proceed immediately to the higher levels of the building to dispense with certain key erudite officials. You will receive your group assignments later this evening.
The attack will occur in 3 days' time, says Evelyn.
Prepare yourselves. This will be dangerous and difficult. But the factionless are familiar with difficulty.
At this, the factionless cheer, and I am reminded that we, the dauntless, are the same people who just a few weeks ago were criticizing abnegation for giving the factionless food and other necessary items. How is that so easy to forget?
And the dauntless are familiar with danger.
Everyone around me punches the air with their fists and screams. I feel their voices inside my head, and the burn of triumph in my chest that makes me want to join them. Evelyn's expression is too empty for someone giving an impassioned speech. Her face looks like a mask.
Down with erudite! Tori yells, and everyone repeats her, all voices joining together regardless of faction.
We share a common enemy. But does that make us friends? I notice that Tobias does not join in the chant, and neither does Christina.
This doesn't feel right, she says.
What do you mean? Lynn says as the voices rise around us. Don't you remember what they did to us? Put our minds under a simulation and forced us to shoot people without even knowing it? Murdered every single abnegation leader?
Yeah, says Christina. It's just invading a faction's headquarters and killing everyone. Isn't that what the erudite just did to abnegation?
This is different. This is not an attack out of nowhere, unprovoked, says Lynn, scowling at her.
Yeah, Christina says. Yeah, I know. She looks at me. I don't say anything. She has a point. It doesn't feel right. I walk toward the Eaton house in search of silence. I open the front door and climb the stairs. When I reach Tobias's old room, I sit on the bed and look out the window, where factionless and dauntless are gathered around the fires, laughing and talking. But they aren't mixed together. There is still an uneasy divide between them,
factionless on one side and dauntless on the other. I watch Lynn, Uriah, and Christina by one of the fires. Uriah snatches at the flames, too quickly to be burned. His smile looks more like a grimace, twisted as it is by grief. After a few minutes, I hear footsteps on the stairs, and Tobias comes into the room, slipping off his shoes by the doorway.
"What's wrong?" he says.
"Nothing, really," I say. "I was just thinking. I'm surprised the factionless agreed to work with Dauntless so easily. It's not like the Dauntless were ever kind to them." He stands beside me at the window and leans into the frame.
"It's not a natural alliance, is it?" he says.
"But we have the same goal." "Right now. But what happens when the goals change? The factionless want to get rid of factions, and the Dauntless don't." Tobias presses his mouth into a line. I suddenly remember Marcus and Johanna, walking together through the orchard. Marcus wore the same expression when he was keeping something from her. Did Tobias get that expression from his father? Or does it mean something different?
"You're in my group," he says, "during the attack. I hope you don't mind. We're supposed to lead the way to the control rooms."
The attack. If I participate in the attack, I can't go after the information Janine stole from Abnegation. I have to choose one or the other. Tobias said that dealing with Erudite was more important than finding out the truth. And if he had not promised the factionless control over all of Erudite's data, he might have been right. But he left me no choice. I have to help Marcus. If there is even a chance that he is telling the truth, I have to work against the people I love best. And right now, I have to lie. I twist my fingers together.
"What is it?" he says.
"I still can't fire a gun." I look up at him. "And after what happened in Erudite headquarters?" I clear my throat. "Risking my life doesn't seem so appealing anymore."
"Triss."
He brushes my cheek with his fingertips.
"You don't have to go."
"I don't want to seem like a coward."
"Hey."
His fingers fit beneath my jaw. They are cool against my skin. He looks sternly at me.
"You have done more for this faction than any other person. You..."
He sighs and touches his forehead to mine.
"You're the bravest person I've ever met. Stay here. Let yourself mend."
He kisses me, and I feel like I am crumbling again, beginning with the deepest parts of me. He thinks I will be here, but I will be working against him, working with the father he despises. This lie is the worst I have ever told. I will never be able to take it back. When we part, I am afraid he will hear my breath shake, so I turn toward the window.
Chapter 39.
"Oh yeah, you totally look like a banjo-strumming softie," says Christina.
"Really?"
"No, not at all, actually. Just let me fix it, okay?" She rummages in her bag for a few seconds and pulls out a small box. In it are different-sized tubes and containers that I recognize as makeup, but wouldn't know what to do with. We are in my parents' house. It was the only place I could think of to go to get ready. Christina has no reservations about poking around. She already discovered two textbooks wedged between the dresser and the wall, evidence of Caleb's erudite leanings.
"Let me get this straight. So you left the Dauntless compound to get ready for war, and took your makeup bag with you?"
"Yep. Figured it would be harder for anyone to shoot me if they saw how devastatingly attractive I was," she says, arching an eyebrow.
"Hold still."
She takes a cap off a black tube about the size of one of my fingers, revealing a red stick. Lipstick, obviously. She touches it to my mouth and dabs it until my lips are covered in color. I can see it when I purse them.
"Has anyone ever talked to you about the miracle of eyebrow tweezing?" she says, holding up a pair of tweezers.
"Get those away from me!"
"Fine," she sighs. "I would take out the blush, but I'm pretty sure it's not the right color for you."
"Shocking, considering we're so similar in skin tone."
"Ha ha," she says. By the time we leave, I have red lips and curled eyelashes, and I'm wearing a bright red dress, and there's a knife strapped to the inside of my knee. This all makes perfect sense. Where's Marcus, destroyer of lives, going to meet us? Christina says. She wears Amity yellow instead of red, and it glows against her skin.
I laugh. Behind Abnegation headquarters.
We walk down the sidewalk in the dark. All the others should be eating dinner now. I made sure of that. But in case we run into someone, we wear black jackets to conceal most of our Amity clothing. I hop over a crack in the cement out of habit.
Where are you two going?
Peter's voice says. I look over my shoulder. He's standing on the sidewalk behind us. I wonder how long he's been there.
Why aren't you with your attack group eating dinner? I say.
I don't have one.
He taps the arm I shot.
I'm injured.
Yeah, right you are, says Christina.
Well, I don't want to go to battle with a bunch of factionless, he says, his green eyes glinting. So I'm going to stay here.
Like a coward, says Christina, her lip curled in disgust.
Let everyone else clean up the mess for you.
Yep, he says with a kind of malicious cheer. He claps his hands.
Have fun dying.
He crosses the street whistling and walks in the other direction.
Well, we distracted him, she says. He didn't ask where we were going again.
Yeah, good. I clear my throat. So this plan? It's kind of stupid, right?
It's not stupid.
Oh, come on. Trusting Marcus is stupid. Trying to get past the Dauntless at the fence is stupid. Going against the Dauntless and Factionless is stupid. All three combined is...
a different kind of stupid, formerly unheard of by humankind.
Unfortunately, it's also the best plan we have, she points out, if we want everyone to know the truth.
I trusted Christina to take up this mission when I thought I would die, so it seems stupid not to trust her now. I was worried she wouldn't want to come with me, but I forgot where Christina came from. Candor, where the pursuit of truth is more important than anything else. She may be dauntless now, but if there's one thing I've learned through all this, is that we never leave our old factions behind.
So this is where you grew up. Did you like it here? She frowns.
I guess you couldn't have if you wanted to leave.
The sun inches toward the horizon as we walk. I never used to like evening light because it made everything in the Abnegation sector look more monochromatic than it already is. But now, I find the unchanging gray comforting.
I like some things and hated some things, I say. And there were some things I didn't know I had until I lost them.
We reach Abnegation headquarters, and its face is just a cement square like everything else in the Abnegation sector. I would love to walk into the meeting room and breathe the smell of old wood, but we don't have time. We slip into the alley next to the building and walk to the back, where Marcus told me he would be waiting. A powder blue pickup truck waits there, its engine running. Marcus is behind the wheel. I let Christina walk ahead of me so that she can be the one to slide into the middle. I don't want to sit close to him if I can help it. I feel like hating him while I work with him lessens my betrayal of Tobias somehow.
You have no other choice, I tell myself. There is no other way.
With that in mind, I pull the door shut and look for a seatbelt to buckle. I find only the frayed end of a seatbelt and a broken buckle.
Where did you find this piece of junk? Says Christina.
I stole it from the factionless. They fixed them up. It wasn't easy to get it to start. Better ditch those jackets, girls.
I ball up our jackets and toss them out the half-open window. Marcus shifts the truck into drive and it groans. I half expect it to stay still when he presses the gas pedal, but it moves. From what I remember, it takes about an hour to drive from the Abnegation sector to Amity headquarters, and the trip requires a skilled driver. Marcus pulls onto one of the main thoroughfares and pushes his foot into the gas pedal. We lurch forward, narrowly avoiding a gaping hole in the road. I grab the dashboard to steady myself.
Relax, Beatrice, says Marcus. I've driven a car before.
I've done a lot of things before, but that doesn't mean I'm any good at them.
Marcus smiles and jerks the truck to the left so that we don't hit a fallen stoplight. Christina whoops as we bump over another piece of debris, like she's having the time of her life.
A different kind of stupid, right? She says,
her voice loud enough to be heard over the rush of wind through the cab. I clutch the seat beneath me and try not to think of what I ate for dinner. When we reach the fence, we see the Dauntless standing in our headlight beams, blocking the gate. Their blue armbands stand out against the rest of their clothing. I try to keep my expression pleasant. I will not be able to fool them into thinking I'm Amity with a scowl on my face. A dark-skinned man with a gun in hand approaches Marcus's window. He shines a flashlight at Marcus first, then Christina, then me. I squint into the beam and force a smile at the man, like I don't mind bright lights in the eyes and guns pointed at my head in the slightest. The Amity must be deranged if this is how they really think, or they've been eating too much of that bread.
So tell me, the man says, what's an abnegation member doing in a truck with two Amity?
These two girls volunteer to bring provisions to the city, Marcus says, and I volunteer to escort them so they would be safe.
Also, we don't know how to drive, says Christina, grinning. My dad tried to teach me years ago, but I kept confusing the gas pedal for the brake pedal, and you can imagine what a disaster that was. Anyway, it was really nice of Joshua to volunteer to take us, because it would have taken us forever otherwise, and the boxes were so heavy.
The Dauntless man holds up his hand.
Okay, I get it.
Oh, of course. Sorry.
Christina giggles.
I just thought I would explain because you seem so confused, and no wonder, because how many times do you encounter this?
Right, the man says. And do you intend to return to the city?
Not any time soon, Marcus says.
All right. Go ahead, then.
He nods to the other Dauntless by the gate. One of them types a series of numbers on the keypad, and the gate slides open to admit us. Marcus nods to the guard who let us through and drives over the worn path to Amity headquarters. The truck's headlights catch tire tracks and prairie grass and insects weaving back and forth. In the darkness to my right, I see fireflies lighting up to a rhythm that is like a heartbeat. After a few seconds, Marcus glances at Christina.
What on earth was that?
There's nothing the Dauntless hate more than cheerful Amity babble, says Christina, lifting a shoulder. I figured if he got annoyed, it would distract him and he would let us through. I smile with all my teeth.
You are a genius.
I know. She tosses her head like she's throwing her hair over one shoulder, only she doesn't have enough to throw.
Except, says Marcus,
Joshua is not an abnegation name.
Whatever, as if anyone knows the difference. I see the glow of Amity headquarters ahead. The familiar cluster of wooden buildings with the greenhouse in their center. We drive through the apple orchard. The air smells like warm earth. Again, I remember my mother stretching to pick an apple in this orchard, years ago, when we came to help the Amity with the harvest. A pang hurts my chest, but the memory doesn't overwhelm me as it did a few weeks ago. Maybe it's because I am on a mission to honor her. Or maybe I'm too apprehensive about what's coming to grieve properly. But something has changed. Marcus parks the truck behind one of the sleeping cabins. For the first time, I notice that there are no keys in the ignition.
How did you get it to start? I ask him.
My father taught me a lot about mechanics and computers, he says, knowledge that I passed to my own son. You didn't think he figured it all out on his own, did you?
Actually, yes, I did.
I push the door open and climb out of the truck. Grass brushes my toes in the back of my calves. Christina stands at my right shoulder and tilts her head back. It's so different out here, she says. You could almost forget what's going on in there. She points her thumb toward the city.
And they often do, I say.
They know what's beyond the city, though, right? She asks.
They know about as much as the Dauntless patrols, says Marcus. Which is that the outside world is unknown and potentially dangerous.
How do you know what they know? I say.
Because that's what we told them, he says, and he walks toward the greenhouse.
I exchange a look with Christina. Then we jog to catch up to him. What does that mean?
When you are entrusted with all the information, you have to decide how much other people should know, says Marcus. The abnegation leaders told them what we had to tell them. Now, let's hope Johanna is keeping up her normal habits. She is usually in the greenhouse this early in the evening.
He opens the greenhouse door. The air is just as dense as the last time I was in here, but now it is misty, too. The moisture cools my cheeks.
Wow, Christina says. The room is lit by moonlight, so it is hard to distinguish plant from tree from man-made structure.
Leaves brush my face as I make my way around the outer edge of the room. And then I see Johanna, crouched beside a bush with a bowl in her hands, picking what appear to be raspberries. Her hair is pulled back, so I can see her scar.
I didn't think I would see you here again, Miss Pryor, she says.
Is that because I'm supposed to be dead? I say.
I always expect those who live by the gun to die by it.
I am often pleasantly surprised. She balances the bowl on her knees and looks up at me.
Although I also know better than to think you came back because you like it here.
No, I say. We came for something else.
All right, she says, standing. Let's go talk about it then.
She carries the bowl toward the middle of the room, where the Amity meetings are held. We follow her onto the tree roots, where she sits and offers me the bowl of raspberries. I take a small handful of berries and pass the bowl to Christina.
Johanna, this is Christina, Marcus says. Candor born dauntless.
Welcome to Amity headquarters, Christina.
Johanna smiles knowingly. It seems so strange that two people born in Candor could end up in such different places, Dauntless and Amity.
Tell me, Marcus, says Johanna. Why have you come to visit?
I think Beatrice should handle that, he says. I am merely the transportation.
She shifts her focus to me without question, but I can tell by the weary look in her eyes that she would rather talk to Marcus. She would deny it if I asked her, but I am almost certain Johanna Reyes hates me. I say, not my most brilliant opening. I wipe my palms on my skirt. Things have gotten bad. The words start to spill out, without finesse or sophistication. I explain that the Dauntless have allied with the Factionless, and they plan to destroy all of Erudite, leaving us without one of the two essential factions. I tell her that there is important information in the Erudite compound, in addition to all the knowledge they possess, that especially needs to be recovered. When I finish, I realize I haven't told her why that has anything to do with her or her faction, but I don't know how to say it.
I'm confused, Beatrice, she says. What exactly do you want us to do?
I didn't come here to ask you for help, I say. I thought you should know that a lot of people are going to die very soon, and I know you don't want to stay here doing nothing while that happens, even if some of your faction does. She looks down, her crooked mouth betraying just how right I am. I also wanted to ask you if we can talk to the erudite you're keeping safe here, I say. I know they're hidden, but I need access to them.
And what do you intend to do? She says.
Shoot them? I say, rolling my eyes.
That isn't funny. I sigh. Sorry. I need information. That's all.
Well, you'll have to wait until tomorrow, Johanna says. You can sleep here.
I sleep as soon as my head touches the pillow, but wake earlier than I planned. I can tell by the glow near the horizon that the sun is about to rise. Across the narrow aisle between two beds is Christina, her face pressed to the mattress with her pillow over her head. A dresser with a lamp on top of it stands between us. The wooden floorboards creak, no matter where you step on them. And on the left wall is a mirror, casually placed. Everyone but the abnegation takes mirrors for granted. I still feel a prickle of shock whenever I see one in the open. I get dressed, not bothering to be quiet. 500 stomping dauntless can't wake Christina when she's deeply asleep, though an erudite whisper might be able to. She is odd that way. I walk outside as the sun peeks through the tree branches and see a small group of Amity gathered near the orchard. I move closer to see what they are doing. They stand in a circle, hands clasped. Half of them are in their early teens, and the other half are adults. The oldest one, a woman with braided gray hair, speaks.
We believe in a God who gives peace and cherishes it, she says. So we give peace to each other and cherish it.
I would not hear that as a cue, but the Amity seem to. They all begin to move at once, finding someone across the circle and clasping hands with them. When everyone is paired off, they stand for several seconds, looking at each other. Some of them mutter a phrase, some smile, some remain silent and still. Then they break apart and move to someone else, performing the same series of actions again. I have never seen an Amity religious ceremony before. I am only familiar with the religion of my parents' faction, which part of me still holds to, and the other rejects as foolishness. The prayers before dinner, the weekly meetings, the acts of service, the poems about a selfless God. This is something different. Something mysterious.
Come and join us, the gray-haired woman says. It takes me a few seconds to realize she's talking to me. She beckons to me, smiling.
Oh, no, I say. I'm just...
Come, she says again, and I feel like I have no choice but to walk forward and stand among them. She approaches me first, clasping my hand. Her fingers are dry and rough, and her eyes seek mine, persistent, though I feel strange meeting her gaze. Once I do, the effect is immediate and peculiar. I stand still, and every part of me is still, like it weighs more than it used to, only the weight is not unpleasant. Her eyes are brown, the same shade throughout, and unmoving.
May the peace of God be with you, she says, her voice low, even in the midst of trouble.
Why would it? I say softly, so no one else can hear.
After all I've done, it isn't about you, she says. It is a gift. You cannot earn it, or it ceases to be a gift.
She releases me and moves to someone else. But I stand with my hand outstretched, alone. Someone moves to take my hand, but I withdraw from the group. First at a walk and then at a run. I sprint into the trees as fast as I can, and only when my lungs feel like they are on fire do I stop. I press my forehead to the nearest tree trunk, though it scrapes my skin, and fight off tears. Later that morning I walk through light rain to the main greenhouse. Johanna has called an emergency meeting. I stay as hidden as possible at the edge of the room, between two large plants that are suspended in mineral solution. It takes me a few minutes to find Christina, dressed in Amity yellow on the right side of the room, but it is easy to spot Marcus, who stands on the roots of the giant tree with Johanna. Johanna has her hands clasped in front of her and her hair pulled back. The injury that gave her the scar also damaged her eye. Her pupil is so dilated it overwhelms her iris, and her left eye doesn't move with the right one as she scans the Amity in front of her. But there are not just Amity. There are people with close, cropped hair and tightly twisted buns who must belong to abnegation, and a few rows of people in glasses who must be erudite. Kara is among them.
I have received a message from the city, says Johanna when everyone quiets down, and I would like to communicate it to you.
She tugs at the hem of her skirt, then clasps her hands in front of her. She seems nervous.
The Dauntless have allied with the Factionless, she says. They intend to attack Erudite in 2 days' time. Their battle will be waged not against the Erudite Dauntless army, but against erudite innocence and the knowledge they have worked so hard to acquire.
She looks down, breathes deeply, and continues.
I know that we recognize no leader, so I have no right to address you as if that is what I am, she says. But I am hoping that you will forgive me, just this once, for asking if we can reconsider our previous decision to remain uninvolved.
There are murmurs. They are nothing like dauntless murmurs. They are gentler, like birds launching from branches.
Our relationship with Erudite notwithstanding, we know better than any faction how essential their role in the society is, she says. They must be protected from needless slaughter,
if not because they are human beings, then because we cannot survive without them. I propose that we enter the city as non-violent, impartial peacekeepers in order to curb in whatever way possible the extreme violence that will undoubtedly occur. Please discuss this. Rain dusts the glass panels above our heads. Johanna sits on a tree root to wait, but the Amity do not burst into conversation as they did the last time I was here. Whispers, almost indistinguishable from the rain, turn to normal speech. I hear some voices lift above others, almost yelling, but not quite. Every lifted voice sends a jolt through me. I've sat through plenty of arguments in my life, mostly in the last 2 months, but none of them ever scared me like this. The Amity aren't supposed to argue. I decide not to wait any longer. I walk along the edge of the meeting area, squeezing past the Amity who are on their feet and hopping over hands and outstretched legs. Some of them stare at me. I may be wearing a red shirt, but the tattoos along my collarbone are clear as ever, even from a distance. I pause near the row of erudite. Kara stands when I get close, her arms folded. "What are you doing here?" she says. "I came to tell Johanna what was going on," I say, "and to ask you for help." "Me?" she says. "Why?" "Not you," I say. I try to forget what she said about my nose, but it's hard. "All of you. I have a plan to save some of your faction's data, but I need your help." "Actually," Christina says, appearing at my left shoulder, "we have a plan." Kara looks from me to Christina, and back to me again. "You want to help erudite?" she says. I'm confused. "You wanted to help Dauntless," I say. "You think you're the only one who doesn't just blindly do what your faction tells you to?" "It is in keeping with your pattern of behavior," says Kara. "Shooting people who get in your way is a Dauntless trait, after all." I feel a pinch at the back of my throat. She looks so much like her brother, down to the crease between her eyebrows, and the dark streaks in her otherwise blonde hair. "Kara," says Christina, "will you help us or not?" Kara sighs. "Obviously I will. I'm sure the others will too. Meet us in the erudite dormitory at the end of the meeting, and tell us the plan." The meeting lasts for another hour. By then the rain has stopped, though water still sprinkles the wall and ceiling panels. Christina and I have been sitting against one of the walls, playing a game in which each of us tries to pin down the other's thumb. She always wins. Finally, Johanna and the others who emerged as discussion leaders stand in a line on the tree roots. Johanna's hair now hangs over her lowered face. She is supposed to tell us the outcome of the conversation, but she just stands with her arms folded, her fingers tapping against her elbow. "What's going on?" Christina says. Finally, Johanna looks up. "Obviously, it was difficult to find agreement," she says. "But the majority of you wish to uphold our policy of uninvolvement." It does not matter to me whether the Amity decide to go into the city or not. But I had begun to hope they were not all cowards, and to me, this decision sounds very much like cowardice. I sink back against the window. "It is not my wish to encourage division in this community, which has given so much to me," says Johanna. "But my conscience forces me to go against this decision. Anyone else whose conscience drives them toward the city is welcome to come with me." At first I, like everyone else, am not sure what she's saying. Johanna tilts her head so that her scar is again visible and adds, "I understand, if this means I can't be a part of Amity anymore." She sniffs. "But please know that I have to leave. I leave you with love rather than malice." Johanna bows in the general direction of the crowd, tucks her hair behind her ears, and walks toward the exit. A few of the Amity scramble to their feet, then a few more, and soon the entire crowd is on their feet, and some of them, not many, but some, are walking out behind her. "That," says Christina, "is not what I was expecting." Chapter 40.
The erudite dormitory is one of the larger sleeping rooms in Amity headquarters. There are 12 beds total, a row of 8 crammed together along the far wall, and 2 pressed together on each side, leaving a huge space in the middle of the room. A large table occupies that space, covered with tools and scraps of metal, and gears and old computer parts and wires. Christina and I just finished explaining our plan, which sounded a lot dumber with more than a dozen erudites staring us down as we talked.
"Your plan is flawed," Kara says. She is the first to respond.
"That's why we came to you," I say, "so you could tell us how to fix it."
"Well, first of all, this important data you want to rescue," she says, "putting it on a disk is a ridiculous idea. Disks just end up breaking or in the wrong person's hands, like all other physical objects. I suggest you make use of the data network."
"The what?" She glances at the other erudite. One of the others, a brown-skinned young man in glasses, says,
"Go on. Tell them. There's no reason to keep secrets anymore."
Kara looks back at me.
"Many of the computers in the erudite compound are set up to access data from the computers in other factions. That's how it was so easy for Janine to run the attack simulation from a Dauntless computer instead of an erudite one."
"What?" says Christina. "You mean you can just take a stroll through every faction's data whenever you want?"
"You can't take a stroll through data," the young man says. "That's illogical."
"It's a metaphor," says Christina. She frowns.
"Right?"
"A metaphor or simply a figure of speech," he says, also frowning. "Or is a metaphor a definite category beneath the heading of figure of speech?"
"Fernando," says Kara, "focus." He nods.
"The fact is," Kara continues, "the data network exists, and that is ethically questionable. But I believe it can work to our advantage here. Just as the computers can access data from other factions, they can send data to other factions. If we sent the data you wish to rescue to every other faction, destroying it all would be impossible."
"When you say we," I say, "are you implying that..."
"That we would be going with you," she says. "Obviously not all of us would go, but some of us must. How do you expect to navigate erudite headquarters on your own?"
"You do realize that if you come with us, you might get shot," says Christina. She smiles.
"And no hiding behind us because you don't want to break your glasses or whatever."
Kara removes her glasses and snaps them in half at the bridge.
"We risked our lives by defecting from our faction," says Kara, "and we will risk them again to save our faction from itself."
"Also," pipes up a small voice behind Kara, a girl no older than 10 or 11 peers around Kara's elbow. Her black hair is short, like mine, and a halo of frizz surrounds her head.
"We have useful gadgets."
Christina and I exchange a look. I say, "What kind of gadgets?"
"They're just prototypes," Fernando says, "so there's no need to scrutinize them."
"Scrutiny's not really our thing," says Christina.
"Then how do you make things better?"
the little girl asks.
"We don't really," Christina says, sighing. "They kind of just keep getting worse."
The little girl nods.
"Entropy."
"What?"
"Entropy," she chirps. "It's the theory that all matter in the universe is gradually moving toward the same temperature, also known as heat death."
"Elia," Kara says, "that is a gross oversimplification."
Elia sticks out her tongue at Kara. I can't help but laugh. I have never seen one of the erudites stick out her tongue before. But then again, I haven't interacted with many young erudite. Only Janine and the people who work for her, including my brother.
Fernando crouches next to one of the beds and takes out a box. He digs inside it for a few seconds, then picks up a small round disc. It is made of a pale metal that I saw often in erudite headquarters, but have never seen anywhere else. He carries it toward me on his palm. When I reach for it, he jerks it away from me.
"Careful!" he says.
"I brought this from the headquarters. It's not something we invented here.
Were you there when they attacked Kander?"
"Yes," I say.
"Right there."
"Remember when the glass shattered?"
"Were you there?"
I say, narrowing my eyes.
"No.
They recorded it and showed the footage at Erudite headquarters, he says. Well, it looked like the glass shattered because they shot at it, but that's not really true. One of the Dauntless soldiers tossed one of these near the windows. It emits a signal that you can't hear, but that will cause glass to shatter.
Okay, I say. And how will that be useful to us?
You may find that it's rather distracting for people when all their windows shatter at once, he says with a small smile. Especially in Erudite headquarters, where there are a lot of windows.
Right, I say. What else have you got? Says Christina.
The Amity will like this, Kara says.
Where is it?
Ah, here. She picks up a black box made of plastic, small enough for her to wrap her fingers around it. At the top of the box are two pieces of metal that look like teeth. She flips a switch at the bottom of the box, and a thread of blue light stretches across the gap between the teeth.
Fernando, says Kara, want to demonstrate?
Are you joking? He says, his eyes wide. I'm never doing that again. You're dangerous with that thing.
Kara grins at him and explains.
If I touched you with this stunner right now, it would be extremely painful, and then it would disable you. Fernando found that out the hard way yesterday. I made it so that the Amity would have a way of defending themselves without shooting anyone.
That's, I frown, understanding of you.
Well, technology is supposed to make life better, she says. No matter what you believe, there's a technology out there for you.
What did my mother say in that simulation?
I worry that your father's blustering about Erudite has been to your detriment.
What if she was right? Even if she was just a part of a simulation. My father taught me to see Erudite a particular way.
He never taught me that they made no judgments about what people believed, but designed things for them within the confines of those beliefs. He never told me that they could be funny, or that they could critique their own faction from the inside.
Kara lunges toward Fernando with the stunner, laughing when he jumps back.
He never told me that an Erudite could offer to help me even after I killed her brother.
The attack will begin in the afternoon, before it is too dark to see the blue armbands that mark some of the Dauntless as traitors. As soon as our plans are finalized, we walk through the orchard to the clearing, where the trucks are kept. When I emerge from the trees, I see that Johanna Reyes is perched on the hood of one of the trucks, the keys dangling from her fingers. Behind her waits a small convoy of vehicles, packed with Amity. But not just Amity. Because Abnegation, with their severe hairstyles and still mouths, are among them. Robert, Susan's older brother, is with them. Johanna hops down from the hood. In the back of the truck she was just sitting on is a stack of crates marked apples and flour and corn. It's a good thing we only have to fit two people in the back.
Hello, Johanna, says Marcus.
Marcus, she says.
I hope you don't mind if we accompany you to the city.
Of course not, he says.
Lead the way.
Johanna gives Marcus the keys and climbs into the bed of one of the other trucks. Christina starts toward the truck cab, and I go for the truck bed, with Fernando behind me.
You don't want to sit up front? Says Christina.
And you call yourself a Dauntless.
I went for the part of the truck in which I was least likely to vomit, I say.
Puking is a part of life.
I am about to ask her exactly how often she intends to throw up in the future when the truck surges forward. I grab the side with both hands so that I don't fall out. But after a few minutes, when I get used to the bumping and jostling, I let go. The other trucks trundle along in front of us, behind Johanna's, which leads the way. I feel calm until we reach the fence. I expect to encounter the same guards who tried to stop us on the way in. But the gate is abandoned, left open. A tremor starts in my chest and spreads to my hands. In the midst of meeting new people and making plans, I forgot that my plan is to walk straight into a battle that could claim my life. Right after I realized that my life was worth living. The convoy slows down as we pass through the fence, like they expect someone to jump out and stop us. Everything is silent, apart from the cicadas and the distant trees and the truck engines.
Do you think it's already started?
I say to Fernando.
Perhaps. Perhaps not, he says.
Janine has many informants. Someone probably told her that something was going to happen, so she called all the Dauntless forces back to Erudite headquarters. I nod, but I'm really thinking of Caleb. He was one of those informants. I wonder why he believes so strongly that the outside world should be hidden from us, that he would betray everyone he supposedly cared about for Janine, who cares about no one.
Did you ever meet someone named Caleb? I say.
Caleb, Fernando says.
Yes, there was a Caleb in my initiate class.
Brilliant, but he was...
What's the colloquial term for it?
A suck-up.
He smirks. There was a bit of a division between initiates. Those who embraced everything Janine said, and those who didn't. Obviously, I was a member of the latter. Caleb was a member of the former.
Why do you ask?
I met him while I was imprisoned, I say. And my voice sounds far away, even to me. I was just curious.
I wouldn't judge him too harshly, says Fernando. Janine can be extraordinarily persuasive to those who aren't naturally suspicious. I have always been naturally suspicious.
I stare over his left shoulder, at the skyline that gets clearer the closer we get to the city. I search for the two prongs at the top of the hub, and when I find them, I feel better and worse at the same time. Better, because the building is so familiar, and worse, because seeing the prongs means that we are getting closer.
Yeah, I say. So have I.
Chapter 41. By the time we reach the city, all conversation has halted in the truck, replaced by pressed lips and pale faces. Marcus steers around potholes the size of a person, and parts from broken-down buses. The ride is smoother when we get out of factionless territory and into the clean parts of the city. Then I hear gunshots. From this distance, they sound like popping. For a moment, I am disoriented, and all I can see are the leaders of abnegation on their knees on the pavement, and the slack-faced Dauntless with guns in hand. All I can see is my mother, turning to embrace the bullets, and Will dropping to the ground. I bite my fist to keep from crying out, and the pain brings me back to the present. My mother told me to be brave. But if she had known that her death would make me so afraid, would she have sacrificed herself so willingly? Breaking away from the convoy of trucks, Marcus turns on Madison Avenue, and when we are just two blocks away from Michigan Avenue, where the fighting is, he pulls the truck into an alley and turns off the engine. Fernando hops out of the truck bed and offers me his arm.
Come on, insurgent, he says with a wink.
What?
I say. I take his arm and slide down the side of the truck. He opens the bag he was sitting with. It is full of blue clothes. He sorts through them, tossing garments to Christina and me. I get a bright blue t-shirt and a pair of blue jeans.
Insurgent, he says.
Noun. A person who acts in opposition to the established authority, who is not necessarily regarded as a belligerent.
Do you need to give everything a name? Says Kara, running her hands over her dull blonde hair, to tuck the stray pieces back.
We're just doing something, and it happens to be in a group. No need for a new title.
I happen to enjoy categorization, Fernando replies, arching a dark eyebrow. I look at Fernando. The last time I broke into a faction's headquarters, I did it with a gun in my hand, and I left bodies behind me. I want this time to be different. I need this time to be different.
I like it, I say.
Insurgent.
It's perfect.
See, Fernando says to Kara, I'm not the only one.
Congratulations, she says wryly.
I stare at my erudite clothes while the others strip off their outer layers of clothing.
No time for modesty, stiff, Christina says, giving me a pointed look.
I know she's right, so I pull off the red shirt I was wearing and put on the blue one instead. I glance at Fernando and Marcus to make sure they aren't watching, and change out of my pants, too. I have to roll up the jeans 4 times, and when I belt them, they bunch at the top like the neck of a crushed paper bag.
Did she just call you stiff? Fernando says.
Yeah, I say. I transferred into Dauntless from abnegation.
Huh,
he frowns. That's quite a shift. That kind of leap in personality between generations is almost genetically impossible these days. Sometimes personality has nothing to do with a person's choice of faction, I say.